This is from John's Gospel, chapter 9. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night comes when no one can work." There are a lot of theologians and biblical scholars that regard this little story in the middle of John's Gospel as the essence of John's message, the man born blind. His case engenders a rather interesting question, one that echoes a lot of what we think, I think, a lot of the time. Who screwed up that this happened? Was it the guy or was it his parents? What's the deal? And Jesus said, "See what he will soon see." That's the central message. Come and see how the works of God might be made manifest in him. In other words, the man born blind is simply an occasion for Jesus to show us a little something about God. By extension, every day in every way with everyone is an opportunity for us to be shown a little something and then to reflect a little something back. And equally important is this sense of urgency that Jesus brings to the story. We must do the works of God while it is day. Night comes when no one can work. So the question is, what are we being shown and how urgently can we reflect it? While we were on vacation, I generally shift my workout regimen a little bit when we're at the beach. I am a runner and try to do that. And when we're at the beach, I run along the beach. It's a little harder to do, and I don't bother with shoes, but it's interesting. It's just different. And, I figure out how long I want to run halfway out and halfway back. And on the turnaround point, I can, for at least a little bit of time, see my own footprints that I've just made, turn around, and run back. And I can see the impact I've made on the beach for about a minute, because very quickly the wave comes and washes away any effect or memory that I've ever been there, which is an interesting, image, but it's also a metaphor. What is life but a moment in time compared to all time, if you will? And yet, it's unique and special and makes a difference. So the question I want to bring in light of this text, that the works of God might be manifest in him, the man born blind, and there's an urgency about it because night comes when no one can work. What if we had a minute? Because that's about how long it took for the waves to wash away my footprints. 1 minute. What if all we had was 1 minute? What works of God might be made manifest in us? Got a minute? In light of that idea, I think having a minute, I would suggest, first of all, we stop yelling. Not just do something, but stop doing something. Stop yelling. The volume of rhetoric in our world is relentless and at sometimes frustrating and cruel. Let me illustrate it in an odd kind of way. Over the course of the last year or so, I've become somewhat philosophic about the seemingly weekly story of active shooter call 911. Relentless, it seems. And what frustrates me about it is not just how frightening it all is, but that it's engendered an enormous amount of yelling. There are two very strongly held sides of opinion about the notion of guns in America, and both sides, every time there's another incident, start yelling at each other. Data, statistics, ideas, not helpful, because it's not about, initially, strategies and statistics. It's about culture. It's about culture. We live in a world where firearms, as well as automobiles, are a part of our identity. In the same way that people grow up saying to their grandchildren, "I've always been a Ford guy," or "Chevy is my car," these are issues that are deeply embedded into our culture. And until we understand the nature of the culture, the place within the culture of dangerous things, and firearms and cars, by the way, are equally dangerous. Lives are lost to the same degree every year in this country from car wrecks, and from shootings. We have learned to live with this. We need to learn, I think, to understand the culture out of which it comes before we can begin to strategize on how in any way to move things forward in a healthy direction. But I think we have to stop yelling. Hateful rhetoric is malignant. And we certainly heard enough hateful and divisive rhetoric coming out of the news this week in a variety of different ways, none of which was helpful. And let me try to draw it together in a different way. Imagine you know someone who is afflicted with the terrible disorder of hearing voices. And ask yourself, what voices are these folks hearing through all the yelling? And to what extent might, through a twisted synapse, lead that person to pick up a gun? So I think if I had 1 minute, I would stop yelling. Because when you stop yelling, you can listen. And you can listen to what makes our culture what it is, what makes it good in so many ways, and how even we can help heal it in others. I want to close off this segment with a very ironic image. I think of Coach Bob Knight, who I'm sure was one of the angriest men that has ever lived in the 20th century. But Coach Bob Knight's basketball offense was centered around this idea, that when the ball was brought up the court, he demanded his players made four passes before they took the shot. Four passes before they took the shot. Set it up, get ready, learn before you act. Metaphorically, what if we listened to and learned four things about the people we're tempted to yell at before we took the shot, before we engaged the conversation? Listening and learning, 4-1. Got a minute? Stop yelling. Listen, 4-1. Secondly, got a minute? Stop yelling. Give something away. I have invented a little game at a restaurant this week. There's a particular restaurant in Lubbock that has as its policy that when you get the check, they've already added in a 20% tip for the waiter or the waitress. Reasonable idea, I guess, and if you don't want to give a 20% tip, if that's not your deal, go to another restaurant. Well, anyway, I think in one instance, at least with me, this sometimes works across purposes. Now, imagine a $20 lunch, just for the sake of arithmetic. Add in a 20% tip, that's $24. $4 on a 20% on a $20 lunch is the tip. Well, it's generally figured before the tax. Now, when I look at a bill, if it's a $20 lunch, the bill says $21.65, because that's what the tax makes for the bill. And I'll generally figure a tip in my head about that. And this week, in that instance, because the service was good and because I just felt like it, I declared that bill to be a $25 lunch bill and tipped a $5 tip, which was 5% extra, 25%. Now, that extra dollar means almost nothing, probably, to me or even to the wait person, except over the course of a shift or the course of a week or the course of a year. If everybody rounded up 5%, imagine the difference in the lives of people who serve you food willingly and then clean up after you. Round up 5%. Give something away. Now, what if that little game in a restaurant became symbolic of a lifestyle? That when we have the opportunity to give away a gratuity or give away some time, give away some insight, give away some love, and we have become so adept and instinctive that rounding up 5%, well, that's not a half bad way to use 1 minute. Got a minute? Round up 5% with your love, with your insight, with a little of your money. And finally, if you've got a minute, find something for which to say thank you. Gratitude. Say thank you. I've been stunned in many instances and sobered and even awed over 33 years of doing this work. The number of times I've encountered people in dreadfully difficult situations, often in a situation where they were very near the end of their lives, and everybody knew it, them especially. And sometimes this happens in a hospital room, sometimes it's at home, but I will walk in and my general opening approach is, well, how are things today? And invariably, I will get from people who are even in desperate, dreadful circumstances, you know what, so-and-so gave me a call. There's the plant from the church. A kid stopped by. Somebody told me a joke. I read something interesting. The first thing said is often a tiny little thing to be grateful for. And I'm not talking about trying to find the glass half full. It's not even close to half full. It's got a couple drops in the bottom, but that's where people start. And if you've just got a minute, that's a good place to go. It seems to me that taking that idea and maybe institutionalizing it in your life means that at the end of each day, no matter how bad the day has been or how good it's been, one thing to be grateful for becomes a prayer of thanks to the God who gave you this day. Now, I have to tell you, in the last couple of months, we've had two fantastic beach trips. I can trade on that for a long time. And yet there are things that are difficult and troublesome. But if at the end of the day, in 1 minute, we say thank you, I think that is a good use of the day which is all we have. Now, you may have noticed that a lot of what I've said so far revolves around perception. How do you see what's going on around you? Do you hear only the yelling, or do you understand the culture beneath it? Do you hear an opportunity to express gratitude? Do you see an opportunity to be generous? It's all a matter of perception. Now, having, in some sense, taken on social media, which is a great source of anger and frustration, I saw something come across social media just the other day that's a poem. I'm just going to read it off of this. It's a poem that you can read down or up. And there's a very big difference on whether you read it forward or by reversal. Today was the absolute worst day ever. And don't try to convince me there's something good in every day. Because when you take a closer look, the world is a pretty evil place. Even if some goodness does shine through once in a while, satisfaction and happiness don't last. And it's not true that it's all in the mind and heart, because true happiness can be obtained only if one's surroundings are good. It's not true that good exists. I'm sure you agree that the reality creates my attitude, it's all beyond my control, and you'll never in a million years hear me say that today was a good day. That's not unfamiliar rhetoric to any of us. We've even said such things to ourselves. And yet, if you read it up from the bottom up, today was a good day. And you'll never in a million years hear me say that it's all beyond my control. My attitude creates the reality. I'm sure you can agree that it's not true that good exists only if one's surroundings are good. True happiness can be obtained because it's all in the mind and heart. And it's not true that satisfaction and happiness don't last. Some goodness does shine through once in a while, even if the world is a pretty evil place. Because when you take a closer look, there's something good in every day. And don't try to convince me that today was the absolute worst day ever. Same words, different order. I learned as a student in pastoral care many years ago that when you are experiencing an encounter with someone who is in distress, in trouble, that's even expressing anger and frustration, that there's a technique called read by reversal, which I just did. It's all a matter of perception. We learned that anger is an outward expression, more often than not, of fear. And we also learned that what people most disown in other people are the things they most fear are true in themselves. So fear is at the heart of a great deal of angry rhetoric. So if you're in a situation where that is a part of what you're about, seek to create a safer environment of listening where the fear can be given verse. Read things by reversal. It is our job to do the work of him who sent us while it is day. Night comes when no one can work. And every person, every encounter, is an opportunity to both experience and reflect a little something about the one who calls us, sends us, keeps us safe, and makes us instruments of his peace. Got a minute? Amen.